Baseball broadcasting legend Vin Scully passes away at the age of 94. Juan Soto splashes his way to San Diego. Tiger Woods offered the moon from LIV Golf. Deshaun Watson suspended for only 6 games. All that, plus some hockey talk on today's episode of Home Field Advantage. Welcome in to another episode of Home Field Advantage. I hope you're having a great week or weekend, whenever and however you may be listening to this podcast across our great country or our great land. My name is Will Highland. It is August 8th, 2022. Hope again that you're having a great time whenever and wherever you're listening to us. Whether that be on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts. We have a loaded show again today, as always. I hope you had a chance to listen to last week's show with Kyle Diesel. We had a ton of fun talking a lot about the NFL, too, which we'll get to a little bit today as it pertains to a scandal that just won't find its way out of the news in one way or another with every new twist and turn, unfortunately. But before that, we again have so many things to get to today. I know we're recording on a Monday, so if you're waiting for it on a Monday, we'll have it out in the afternoon. And if you know that, you're listening to that. So I guess it doesn't matter there. But nevertheless, I digress. We have a loaded show. So we're actually going to start out with reporting on some big news that happened last week. So Vin Scully passed away on August 2nd, about a week ago. Vin Scully, of course, the legendary baseball broadcaster, Los Angeles Dodgers voice for decades, if not half a century, and truly one of the most well-known gentleman in sports broadcasting, and just want to offer condolences to his family who, you know, ultimately lost a cornerstone of their family. And, you know, I got to thinking last week, we lost Bill Russell and Vin Scully in the span of like 3 days. You know, so those are two huge icons in the sports world in America, who were known for their strong character and who lived deep into their 80s and 90s. So certainly lived full lives that touched multiple generations. So certainly thoughts and prayers with the Scully family if someone's been a part of the world for 94 years. They've again left a legacy behind that is paramount to their family's history. So certainly praying for the Scullies who lost an institution like Vin, and the baseball world especially. He is a voice of so many summer nights for those who live in California and for those who love the sport. So certainly wanted to touch on that at the beginning. But while we're also on the subject of baseball, baseball has heated up. It is post All-Star break. We are in the thick of it here, heading toward the pennant race season as we get into mid-August, late August, and then to September. We're past the trade deadline, and baseball is heating up. Some of these pennant races are really starting to get interesting. The Brewers, as I predicted, just want to point that out, as I said way back in June, the Brewers are falling in the second half again, and the Cardinals, who I was high on, are ascending. We'll touch on that more in a second. But what everyone seems to be talking about is Juan Soto and his departure from the Nationals to the San Diego Padres, along with Bell, Josh Bell, and they have found their way to the West Coast to another pennant race, to another great rivalry. And the San Diego Padres are in the thick of it as well. You start looking around at who that team has, you know, in their at their disposal, some of their pitchers they have. They got some veteran pitchers, you know, whether it be Yu Darvish or Blake Snell or anyone else who are part of that team now, part of that identity of the Padres, in partnership with guys like Manny Machado and Fernando Tatis Jr., who I know has been hurt recently and was struck out in a rehab assignment. Shout out Cody Lawyerson, UMaine grad. But the Padres are still a legit team. I know last year the rivalry really ended up being the San Francisco Giants and the Dodgers in the playoffs. But the Padres, I think, are for real now that they've got Juan Soto. And so that's obviously where a lot of the attention in the National League is heading. But I'll just say it again. You got Jacob DeGrom back with the Mets. The Mets look good. Jacob DeGrom looks good. He's going to get paid. And then elsewhere in the National League, you have the Cardinals, who I said don't sleep on the St. Louis Cardinals. Right? Don't sleep on the St. Louis Cardinals. Between Dylan Carlson and Paul DeJong and some of their other role players who have ascended to be key contributors this summer, you've also got the old reliables, Albert Pujols, Yadier Molina. They're searching. They're searching for a World Series title. And then you can't forget about who I believe to be two of the top five players in the National League, Paul Goldschmidt and Nolan Arenado. Those guys are going to be Hall of Famers as well. So the Cardinals, and then, you know, you throw in Adam Wainwright. Cardinals got like at least four or five future Hall of Famers on that team. And they're going to make some noise because, as I've said before, that's a baseball town. That's a town that expects to win. And the St. Louis Cardinals are peaking at the right time. You know, they just swept the Yankees for the first time in franchise history, I read. Both of those franchises have been around since World War I era or earlier, right? So and they've played each other in the World Series 100 years ago. And so for that to be the first time is pretty wild. And what else is wild is that when teams like this get hot in August, you know, when the trade deadline's in the rear view, everyone's looking toward the pennant races. You got an expanded playoff picture now in both leagues. The Cardinals could find themselves in that two or three spot in the National League where they might end up picking one of their opponents, right? And that's a team I would not want to go face. I don't want to go to that yard in October with the legends that they've had, you know, the World Series champions in 2006 and 2011. You know, they've been to the World Series in 13 and in 04. That's a franchise that in recent history, as I've said before, is a legit franchise. You know, no disrespect to the Padres or, you know, the Mets, but those teams haven't had the success recently. So there's that culture of winning that I believe exists in St. Louis. And so for that reason, I would say look out for the St. Louis Cardinals again. And if you don't believe me now, like you didn't believe me in June, look at the way they've been playing. I believe they've won seven in a row at this point, if I'm not mistaken. So the Cardinals are legit, and so do not sleep on St. Louis. I think the AL wild card is still wide open. Obviously, the Blue Jays, the Mariners, the Rays, they're sort of hanging out at the top, and then you've got sort of the second tier with the Twins, the Indians, sorry, the Guardians, Red Sox, Orioles, all kind of hanging around, Blue Jays, they're further up. So I think the AL wildcard is wide open still. A little bit disappointed in my Red Sox. They acquire Eric Hosmer and Tommy Pham and some good pieces, but they lose Christian Vasquez, and they didn't improve their pitching staff really. So that is bothersome to me, but they're still in it. Weird to think that the Orioles are in it and they, you know, traded their closer there and Trey Mancini. But I think the AL wildcard's still wide open. But I guess my thesis is watch out for the Chicago White Sox, who I just omitted mentioning them now too, and watch out for the St. Louis Cardinals. Those are two teams that, as I told Diesel last week, I think are going to have great second halves. I think the Mariners will be right there. I think a really fun World Series would be the Mariners and the Cardinals, or the White Sox and the Cardinals. I think that would be pretty fun. I just Houston and New York, it just doesn't do anything for me. Maybe that's some Red Sox bias. And then I'm kind of sick of the Dodgers, so I think that would be a fun World Series. And then don't forget in the National League East, you have the defending champion Braves, who are still a great team. You just signed Austin Riley to a long-term contract. And the New York Mets, who I mentioned earlier, they're going to be contending, and that would be fun. A New York Mets World Series appearance would be cool too. I guess my thesis on baseball is keep an eye out. This is the one year that I didn't predict the Mariners to be really hot, and they've been really good. I would keep an eye on the St. Louis Cardinals as being the second half Cinderella team. All right, speaking of keeping an eye on stuff, I am a little intrigued by the LIV Golf news that's been made. I didn't have Greg Norman talking to Tucker Carlson about LIV Golf on my sports bingo board for the summer. But last week, some news was made when Norman revealed that the rumors regarding Tiger Woods' offer to go play in LIV Golf being in the $700 to $800 million range were accurate, those rumors were accurate. That they were offering Tiger Woods that to begin with is unbelievable. He's, of course, declined. So it does bring up two interesting questions. The first is, how much money is enough money to get somebody like that over there, right? You know, you look at a guy like Tiger Woods, who's at points in his career had more money than countries have in GDP, obviously. So he certainly deserving because of that, I would say, in what he would bring to that tour in terms of eyeballs and legitimacy and whatnot. Because really, you know, Phil Mickelson, Dustin Johnson, some of these guys that have gone over there, Brooks Koepka and DeChambeau, they have cred in the golf world, but nobody carries the clout that Tiger Woods carries. So I guess that's my point, would be that there's that overarching theme of how much money is enough money to land somebody like that, right? Like, how much to get somebody who would move the needle? Because he wouldn't move the needle, I believe, with LIV Golf, give it the legitimacy it craves right now, because it's still very controversial, which is sort of the second question. How would that impact the Tiger Woods legacy? Because at this point, if you were to leave now, it would be pretty dicey, right? Like, people still look at that tour. The golf inner circles do not like the LIV Tour, despite the fact that it's, you know, Greg Norman's the face of that tour, and as Cam said, it's killing the PGA. So there's certainly some some animosity within the golf world as it pertains to the LIV Tour. But how would it impact Tiger Woods' legacy? This is a guy who early on was bigger than I think any superstar in sports, right? We had just come out of sort of the Michael Jordan era of the NBA with the Bulls and whatnot in the late 90s. And that's sort of when Tiger Woods started to ascend very, very fast. 1997 through 2000 into the early 2000s. And Tiger Woods was seen as this prodigy, this, you know, guy who made it, you know, this mixed race guy who made it in a white man's game, so to speak. Obviously, that's not the case, but that was obviously what people thought at the time. You know, he was breaking all these barriers and doing all this stuff and living up to everyone's expectations, right? And then you saw at the end of the 2000s, when his legacy took a hit following those affair rumors and the injuries and the car accident, the original car accident. And then, you know, he had the DUI charge, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And then obviously that horrific car accident last year. But then, of course, he came back and he played at the Masters and he won the Masters in 2019 prior to this accident. And everything else that goes along with Tiger Woods is, you know, career arcs. His legacy has withstood a sex scandal. It's withstood the early racial prejudice that he faced. It's withstood the obvious drug and alcohol problems that he had. It withstood the car accidents. He's sort of built, you know, he got built up so high and then fell so far and then he built up again. Like, how many times is Tiger Woods willing to rebuild and build his standing is the question. And for me, I think that there will come a time when the animosity begins to wane, either by way of the PGA being irrelevant and LIV becoming the golf experience that everyone wants, right? You think about the Capital One's The Match, very similar to LIV in that it's less intense, more casual, but the quality of golf is still, you know, among the highest just because of who's participating. There will come a day where either that will happen, the animosity will wane because LIV becomes the more legitimate tour, or the skepticism about the Saudi Arabian stuff and, you know, the moral things that go into that will eventually start to get memory hold, the way a lot of that stuff tends to happen, right? Everyone's clutching their pearls about this and that. You know, it's the same thing that happened with the NFL, right? There were a lot of right-wing people who were like, I'm never going to watch the NFL again because of the, you know, anthem stuff. And the NFL said, you know, we're gonna move beyond this eventually. And they did. And some of those people ended up back watching football. Maybe not in the same intensity that they used to, but eventually a lot of them made their way back, I would say, just based on the way the ratings have rebounded. But with golf, in this situation in particular, there could come a time when the controversy around going and taking money from the Saudi Arabians starts to become less of a talking point, because it's just sort of accepted. That tends to happen with some of these big controversies. I don't know the answer. I don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other about LIV. I don't like the fact that these golfers are going over and getting in bed with those guys, so to speak. I don't like that a lot of these guys are getting these big payouts and, you know, not necessarily playing the amount of golf that they used to play, right? Like, they're getting paid like double what they used to in some instances and playing less golf. Yeah, I don't really like that, but I guess that's the free market, right? So that's the other side of it is, look, like, if the PGA wants to fend off this trend, then be better. I don't know exactly what they do. Do they make the purses bigger? I have no idea. Do they incentivize sponsors more? Do they leverage their relationships globally? I don't know. But what I do know is if Tiger Woods decides to go over there in some time, some way, it will be the biggest thing. The biggest story that golf's ever seen would be the face of the PGA for decades leaving the PGA to go play in a sort of new circuit tour that a lot of people don't like. That would be the biggest thing to happen in the history of golf in terms of off the course. I don't think it's going to happen in the near future, basically because of what I've already said. There's still that stigma, there's still that animosity and that controversy surrounding the two tours, fans' perception, legacies, all that stuff. So I don't think it's going to happen in the near future. But it's definitely something to keep an eye on as we head forward. All right, another thing to keep an eye on as we head forward, you know, I've kind of been using that segue here, but this is what I try and do. I try and elevate some topics that I think are pertinent to water cooler conversations, right? And one of those is this Deshaun Watson mess. I was going to call it a situation, but at this point, it's more of a mess. And the first thing I have to say about this Deshaun Watson situation is it is grotesque. You know, I'm usually, as we've said before, a couple months ago, when Kyle Diesel and Cam Kasel were both on my program, we talked about Liv and about Deshaun Watson back-to-back in that episode, too. My opinion hasn't changed in 8 weeks really on either, not really on Liv and not really on this. With this Deshaun Watson saga mess, my opinion is pretty simple. It's grotesque, some of these allegations. I don't care whether it's been proven in a criminal court or not. At this point, when you have that many accusers, you know, it's not like, to me, some of these other situations, you can tell that there's more to the story that doesn't get reported. I really don't think there's more to the story here. You know, I really don't. And, you know, obviously a guy's innocent until he's proven guilty in a criminal court or in a civil court of law. And I get all that. But to me, what makes this different is you have 20 to 25 plus allegations. You're telling me there's not one, you're telling me there's not one of those that's true? Because even if there's one, to me, it's enough, clearly. And also with this situation that makes it very different is we know that the Texans knew about it because of they were supplying Watson with these hotel rooms and whatnot. So that's just bizarre. That's just bizarre to me, that's not being talked about more. But I guess beyond the grotesqueness of all these allegations, right? I'm not going to try and be judge, juror, and executioner. That's why we have a court system. But because of this court system, I think the blame is being misplaced. Obviously, 100% of the blame lies, in Watson's camp, right? He's the perpetrator, 100%. But in terms of the six-game suspension that has caused fans to go in an uproar, let's remember that the NFL wants to suspend him for longer. So as much as we hate the NFL and the way that Goodell and his cronies have handled the Ray Rice thing, the Kareem Hunt thing, the Tyreek Hill thing, all these, the Ezekiel Elliott thing, Greg Hardy, all these other domestic violence cases, it's sad that I could name like six of them without even trying. All these other domestic violence cases, absolutely they've botched every single time. But in this case, I truly think they wanted to suspend him for the whole year. But they had this independent judge or whatever, Susan Robinson or whatever her name is. I can't remember her name. I think it's, is it Susan Robinson? Is it Ann Robinson? No, it's Sue L. Robinson. Right. Okay, that's her name. She was the one that issued the 6-game suspension, had a 16-page report. Ian Rappaport was able to obtain it. She believed the NFL carried their burden of proof with a preponderance of the evidence that he had violated the conduct policy by engaging in sexual assault and conduct that poses a genuine danger to the safety and well-being of another person, yada, yada, yada. And then ultimately the integrity of the NFL is the point that she was charged with upholding. But despite all that, the outcry about the 6-game suspension is sort of, in my opinion, misplaced. Like, look, like we all don't, as I said, mad at the NFL. But in this case, it was really this independent judge that ruled on the by this second disciplinary officer, right? She was the one that independently ruled on this suspension. Obviously, the NFLPA will countersue, right, and say like, are you know really about the money, probably. You know, but, you know, they'll look out for the best interest of the union and their client, which is the player, right? And the league actually wants more of a suspension, and they want him to take some sort of correctional education action, right? So I think in most cases, we look at the NFL, we look at Goodell, and it's Goodell who issues the suspension, and we look at him, and we're like, you know, what the heck? And I guess ultimately the buck does stop with him because, you know, this disciplinary officer was likely appointed, you know, and we'll, there's a lot of legal sports legalese that goes into all this, that I don't really want to get in the weeds with. And I, again, don't know the entire background story. But what I do know, is that it's hard to say that there's more to the story than what was found in this report, in this ruling. And I think I really think that this is really reflects more to me on this independent arbiter, if you're going to be mad about the suspension ruling. And actually, when it comes right down to it, you got to look at the Cleveland Browns, because the Cleveland Browns are truly, truly the clowns in this situation. They're more like the Cleveland clowns, because they gave this guy guaranteed money. They, for his contract this year, they backloaded it, knowing that it was likely he was going to get suspended. They don't care. They simply do not care that they have somebody with these sort of allegations on their roster. And their statement after the fact was an absolute joke. If I'm a female fan of the Cleveland Browns, I don't know how I wake up and still support them after what they've said. And, you know, I try not to clutch my pearls about this stuff because it's ultimately, you know, out of my control, obviously. But I look at this and, you know, while I don't know all the answers, it is an absolute mess because it's not over. If you thought the 6-game suspension was going to be the end of it, it's not. He's going to hear it everywhere he goes. The Browns are going to hear it. This judge, I mean, isn't going to be the most popular person in the world. And ultimately, the NFL is going to take it on the chin because they've allowed this to exist without taking action sooner. So I guess if you want to get on the NFL for that, you certainly can. But in terms of the 6-game suspension, while the NFL deserves some blame, but I think a lot of the anger is misdirected, needs to be directed at the judge, needs to be directed at the Browns, needs to be directed ultimately at Watson. Because I think the NFL, if they had their way, they would say, yeah, last year was pretty much a de facto suspension, but this year, you're you're gone, and you gotta do correctional action to make sure that you change your behavior long term. And you know, I've seen memes about on Twitter and whatever about this massage therapy conference going on in Cleveland, and people making light of that. I think that's equally as grotesque, in my opinion. You know, I'll just end it here, I guess, is that you can't, on one hand, say and stand on your soapbox and talk about how much you want the NFL to change and how much this is serious stuff and that everyone needs to take it seriously. And then you go out and you share a meme and you laugh at a meme about obviously a coincidence that there's this massage therapy conference going on in Cleveland. Clearly a coincidence. But you know, those making it like, oh, this is why he signed with the Browns. That's not in good taste, in my opinion. If you're that serious about this sort of stuff, in the sports world and getting it out, especially with what's been going on up in Canada with their national hockey team or what's been going on in our country at Michigan State. I mean, if you want to truly get this stuff out of sports, then I get it's time for the jokes to end. You know, there's obviously a time and place for everything, but in my opinion, when it comes to this stuff, we can find other things to laugh at. There's plenty of other things about the NFL to laugh at, plenty of other things about the Cleveland Browns to laugh at. But in this case, I just want to set that aside. The other big story in the NFL is this Dolphins drama going on. I'm not a big expert on this topic either, but there's been some tampering allegations, in some discoveries that they were in fact trying to contact Tom Brady and Sean Payton while both individuals were still under contract with the Patriots and Saints, respectively, and when Brady was a member of the Buccaneers as well. There's been a lot of talk about whether Brady should be implicated in this, whether Sean Payton should be implicated in this. I would say Payton more than Brady, simply because coaches generally have a little bit more lateral autonomy when it comes to their futures. I don't think it's a coincidence at all that both of those guys decided they were going to quote unquote retire. I also don't think it's a coincidence, and call me a conspiracy theorist, that it was via Bill Belichick that Brian Flores found out about the Giants going with Brian Daboll, therefore leading to some of these investigations into his past and ultimately the Dolphins and everything about that lawsuit, sort of helping to unearth these tampering discoveries. And I guess, really, the whole thing about this is it's just one of those NFL things that just gets too messy and involves a million different teams. And, you know, you think about the Gruden stuff going on as well, and now the Watson situation involving the Browns and the Texans, the Gruden situation involving the Raiders, the Washington football team, among others, and now this Dolphins situation affecting the Saints, the Buccaneers, and the Patriots as well. You know, so you've got a quarter of the league, really. You've got four teams plus another three being affected. The Giants, too, really. So you've got the Giants, the Patriots, the Dolphins, the Saints, the Buccaneers, the Browns, the Texans, all being affected by these various stories. Let alone the Washington football team and the Raiders. So that's 9 teams out of 32 among 3 scandals. So this is the kind of stuff that people just get sick of. You know, I don't know all the answers about Deshaun. I don't know what's going on with the Dolphins. But what I do know is this stuff is just not what the NFL wants to be talking about leading up to a season. Leading up to really their first legit full season post-COVID, right? Their first big season in which the TV naming rights are going to start to be talked about even more. You think about Amazon Prime coming into the fold and all this other stuff happening with all the broadcasters moving around, all the money that's going to be due, all the talks about going to London and this and that. And it is not what a expanding business wants to spend time talking about, but it's totally self-inflicted because they've let this culture of immorality, really, as well as I guess the term I would say would be inter-drama, Housewives of Atlanta kind of drama, right? Like, it's really reality TV in certain ways. So not a great look for the NFL, and I don't think it's a coincidence either that both of these stories came out in the same week, one right after the other. They protect their own in this league a lot. It's a cartel, but it is the most entertaining cartel in the world, I would argue. So the NFL is king in this country. They own a day of the week. And it will continue. It will continue to be that way, for the near future, at least. All right. Speaking of the near future, so the Arizona Coyotes over in the NHL released a rendering of their arena at the Arizona State University campus, and it's got about 5,000 to 7,000 seats, if I remember correctly. And it's been met with nothing but memes and jokes. So there's really two ways, again, to look at this, right? So there's always two sides to every story, I believe. Whether both sides are correct is a different conversation. But in this case, there are two sides to the story. And the first one being that Arizona probably shouldn't have an NHL franchise. They probably shouldn't have, right? It's just not a fan base that I don't think really has a hunger to build a new arena. And I don't care whether you live in Mesa, Tempe, Phoenix, anywhere else around that area. It's just not a spot where you're going to get hardcore hockey fans. But I think it's, as I saw on Twitter, I think it's Gary Bettman's Waterloo. I think he's, or his Little Bighorn, I think he's going to plant his flag in Arizona and keep it there until it costs him his job. He's that committed. Because he does not want to relocate another franchise. He does not want another Atlanta Thrashers situation. And I get it. There's a ton of risk involved with that. But just objectively speaking, this is not Nashville. This isn't even Dallas. This is certainly not Tampa or Carolina. It's not a warm weather city that has an appetite for it. The Kings and the Ducks somehow do well because they, you know, they've had legitimacy for a few decades now, whether it was because of Wayne Gretzky or the movie or some recent cups in the Kings case or some strong players in the Ducks case. The Ducks and the Kings do well in LA because it's LA. Phoenix, Arizona is just not it, Chief. It doesn't matter if you rename the team the Arizona Coyotes rather than the Phoenix Coyotes. It doesn't change a thing. That city just probably doesn't care about hockey. And that's okay. Not every city needs to love the NHL or the NBA. Not every city needs to have an NFL or an MLB team. It's just not part of the culture. And that's okay. It's okay. You I know ASU has a hockey team. I know Tucson's got a team in the A. Like, I know the Coyotes have been around, you know, a couple decades now, and you know, they've got cool uniforms, and Austin Matthews is from Arizona, and I get all that. I get the economic and financial incentive for trying to make that a hockey market. I just don't think it's in the cards. And so that's the first point, is it's probably not a great place to be. The second thing is, though, you look at that arena and everyone's talking about, oh, well, you know, that's a joke of an arena. All right. Well, how many times is a Toronto Maple Leaf fan going to go to Arizona? Right? Like, how many times? They're not in the same conference. They might go there once a year. That's it. Even if you're a diehard fan that goes to every game, all 82 games, you can afford that. You're never going to go to that arena. So who the hell cares if it's small or big? I just got done telling you that the fans probably don't care. It's actually going to be better, probably a better atmosphere for a small barn to be packed than a big barn to be 20% full. So us diehard fans up here in the north, the northeast in Canada, in the northwest even, who cares if Arizona's arena is small? We ain't going there. Do the players go there? The players go there once a year if you live up there. Even if you're in the Pacific Division, you know, if you play for Calgary or Edmonton or Vancouver or Seattle or the Sharks, probably going to go there a handful of times a year. It's one of 32 arenas. Who the hell cares if it's small and it looks like a clown show? Because the TV product, you probably won't be able to tell that much. They're going to pump in noise on the TV if they have to. So I'm not too concerned about it. I'm, as an NHL fan. What I am concerned about, though, is if Bettman is willing to plant his flag there and wait for the tsunami, then what does that say about some of these other cities that might end up being in need, right? That might need the league's help, that aren't getting it, as far as I know. Like, what does that say about a place like San Jose, who might end up needing a new arena in the coming decade? Or a place like Dallas, who's also in a warm weather spot. What if they need the help of Arizona? Like, how many hands in the pot is Gary Bettman going to use? I mean, I know Bill Daly, the deputy commissioner, is certainly capable of lending a hand. But, you know, we've seen the Florida Panthers come up, but what if they're not good forever? Like, what if they need it? Like, I know they got Tkachuk and Barkov and other guys, so they're going to be relevant for a while. But what happens when Calgary, a city that needs a new arena for sure, that's got three teams playing in it, one in the WHL, a new A team, the Wranglers, plus the Flames, what happens if they need the help of the NHL? Are they going to get it? What kind of help is that going to look like? Are they going to get backed the way that Bettman is backing a city that probably doesn't give a you-know-what about the sport? I have no idea. The only thing that could save the Coyotes, I would say, would be if Matthews found his way there. Because if Matthews found his way there, probably not going to happen. It would give them a legit bona fide American-born superstar right around the time of the next Olympic situation. I'll put it at that, because we don't know what that's going to look like. The team would have some legitimacy. Would they ever get a new arena built in Tempe, in Phoenix, in Glendale, anywhere? That's a great question. So I don't know who's going to save the Coyotes. I know a lot of Eastern Canadians want Quebec City to get a new team. They deserve a team. Hamilton, Ontario is another one that everyone keeps throwing around. I don't know about that. People talk about a lot of teams in Atlantic Canada. I don't think that would ever really work. A place like Seattle, they got their team. They deserve their team. Seattle needed a team. You look at some other cities around the country. What about Kansas City? What about Omaha? Some Midwest. But I guess Houston even. We know Houston, their owner, the Rockets owner, really wants a team. But I think 32 is the magic number That's how many teams they have now. So I don't think there's going to be a new team going anywhere unless it's the Coyotes moving or another team moving. And so for that reason, I wouldn't hold your breath when it comes to the Arizona Coyotes. All right, just wrapping up the show here with one more quick headline I just saw this morning. Patrice Bergeron signs a one-year deal with the Bruins. I don't know the details of the contract yet. I bet it will be laced with a ton of incentives. I know that makes it sound like a drug, but, you know, watching Patrice Bergeron play hockey is pretty addicting. It's going to be a great time. Maybe I shouldn't make jokes about that. I just got done talking about jokes, but I'm getting off track here. Patrice Bergeron coming back for another year is exactly what the Bruins need. That would have been a massive hole without him, especially when you think about that they still got a team. I know everyone likes to talk about the Bruins and they're not really that good and this and that anymore. You know, they still got Brad Marchand, albeit he's hurt. Same with Charlie McAvoy, Matt Grizzlick. You got Swayman, full second year again. You've got Hampus Lindholm signed to a big deal. You've got puck-moving defensemen that are young, whether that's somebody like Jack O'Shan or anyone else they got down in Providence whose names are escaping me. But they've got Fabian Lysell and Mason Lorai, that's what I was thinking of, coming up the wings. You have opportunities, if you're the Bruins, to rebuild a little bit, retool, and still carry that Krejci Bergeron Marchand core as long as you can, especially when it's rumored that Krejci's going to be coming back. Just adding David Krejci, and you basically missed out on Pavel Zacha. Sorry, you missed out on Eric Halla in exchange for Pavel Zacha. Those guys kind of cancel each other out. If you get Krejci, you're probably going to have to move another winger. Probably somebody like Craig Smith to clear some cap space. Maybe Tomas Nosek or somebody like that. But you've got options. You have a team that isn't that still not that far removed from some deeper playoff runs. But the only caveat is you have a loaded Eastern Conference. But make no mistake, Patrice Bergeron coming back for another year. Obviously, his 19th season, I wouldn't expect him to be the same amazing player for all 82 games. But we saw last year, he was a Selke Award winner. And somebody who still has the leadership ability as the captain to lead this team. It would be a huge hole just losing a captain. And also, for a guy like Patrice Bergeron, you have the familiarity that he has with David Pastrnak, who I didn't even just mention, or Brad Marchand, or Jake DeBrusk, who you could expect a big year out of. You know, I just think that he's still a player who you can rely on to be a top line center, and that's exactly what they need him to be, and he can still be that. And make no mistake, the addition of David Krejci will certainly add to that if they can swing that. But I think the Boston Bruins are a better team today than they would have been for sure if we were still wondering what was going to happen with Bergeron. So for Bergeron to come back, I just hope the Bruins can put it together for him. Who knows? You could have Swayman have a Shesterkin-like season that leads them to the Eastern Conference Finals or something like that, and then have the leadership of Bergeron, Krejci, Marchand put you over the top. I don't know. The NHL is crazy. Obviously, the Avalanche won last year. A lot of people expected them to, right? But you look at recent years, some of these teams that make the final are not always the team that you expected to in August. So just keep that in mind, especially if the Bruins can get some contributions from some young guys like Beecher or Lorai or Lysell or whoever's ready to join the NHL this year. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Home Field Advantage. I hope you have a great rest of your week. We'll be back next week with another full episode where we'll talk about whatever happens between now and then. If you haven't already, please subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that's on Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, wherever. You can also follow us on Instagram at HomeFieldPod and on Twitter at HomeFieldPod. Come out with some new content there once in a while. But until next time, I hope you have a great rest of your week. My name is Will Hound, and you've been listening to Home Field Advantage. If you liked this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite provider, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. Be sure to also check out Filling Up with Kyle Diesel, our brand new program developed under the Sportland USA Podcast Network. Home Field Advantage, The Morning Advantage, and Filling Up are presented by Sportland USA, and the opinions shared with them do not reflect those of any other company, outlet, person, or entity.